chapter 5 of the sutra that we looked at quite thoroughly. We could say it was a kind of like a psychological picture of how things work and how we experience, you know, setting up these eight consciousnesses and you know, the structure of the mind like that. So now chapter 6 is, we could say, more like an epistemological description of the mind. Epistemology is the study of how we know things. So if that was a description of the structures of the mind, that these eight consciousnesses and how that works, now this is more about how we actually know things and project falseness onto things and so on. And my feeling is that that previous chapter and the eight consciousnesses, although that's maybe the most well-known part of Yogacara or mind only, with the storehouse consciousness and all that, that actually that's just kind of like the setup for this chapter on the three characteristics of all phenomena, sometimes called the three natures. And this is more like the central meditation chapter. I feel like this really gives, offers a really workable contemplation or meditation that you can bring into Zazen or just any moment. And we did try talking about the consciousnesses in terms of, you could imagine some contemplations or meditations where you're trying to see how the mind is putting forth the sense gate and the sense object at the same time in this non-dual way, things like that. A little bit more imaginative, I think, to do those kinds of contemplations. But this seems more straightforward to me. This chapter in the Tibetan is called The Questions of Gunakara. And in the Chinese, it's called The Characteristics of All Phenomena. Phenomena means dharmas. And in this school, and actually I would say every Buddhist school from the beginning, phenomena means mental phenomena, means like things that we experience. But Yogacara, mind only, of course, makes that very explicit and is pointing out the fact that everything that we think of as phenomena really is merely our experience. So it's the characteristics of all phenomena chapter, and this phenomena characteristics, or dharma characteristics, in Chinese fa xiang, or Japanese ho so, is actually the name of the Yogacara school in China and Japan. Strangely, they didn't call it mind only or yoga practice. They renamed the school the Dharma Characteristics School for some reason in East Asia. And I like to think that the reason maybe they did that was because of this chapter. This is the title of this chapter, the three characteristics, is such an important teaching. Thank you very much. And there's still, I think, a very small Hoso school in Japan. If you ever have been to Nara, which is the old capital, not far from Kyoto, there's one of those big historic national temples called Kofukuji, I think. Has anyone been to Nara? It's where Todaiji is, the biggest wooden building in the world, where there's this giant Buddha from like the 8th century and that's the head of the Avatamsaka school, which I think has like one temple left in the country. And the one temple of this mind-only school is next door to that. And I think there are some practitioners, and there's at least one American Hoso priest who lives in San Francisco, or Berkeley. He's Robert Scharf is his name, and he's a professor who gives classes and more a scholar than a practitioner. And he actually told his story that the only reason he became a Hoso priest was that to get access to the texts that were only in that temple, that you had to be a priest to access some old Japanese texts. So, but he is representing that school. He's not particularly so into mind only, I think, but at some time he wanted to read something about it. Okay, so we have the three characteristics of all phenomena. And getting into this chapter and remembering again, I think, whenever we get into these things, maybe each class we should remember these three kinds of wisdom, right? That we're just trying to conceptually understand this kind of complicated thing. And there's a kind of wisdom that comes with this wisdom through hearing or studying the teachings in a conceptual way. We get a new picture, a new conceptual picture of how things might work. And that's mainly what we're doing in here. So if it feels like this has nothing to do with meditation or freedom from suffering, my strong faith is that it does have something to do with it. And this is the work in according to the system that we're doing first. And then as you recall, remember this, the second kind of wisdom?
Contemplating.
Yeah, the wisdom from the teachings that we heard, now we contemplate them, reflect on them, and in our own experience. So that's when it starts to become not just like being force-fed some dogma or something, but actually, is this true? Like really checking it out for ourselves. And then the third type?
Living it?
Living it or bringing it into meditation or cultivation. And this chapter, I think, offers a way to do this. The questions of Gunakara. Then the Bodhisattva Gunakara, whose name I think means something like source of good qualities, questioned the Bhagavan. Bhagavan, when you say Bodhisattvas are wise with respect to the character of phenomena, Bodhisattvas are wise with respect to the character of phenomena. Bhagavan, just how are Bodhisattvas wise with respect to the character of phenomena? Or we could say, or characteristics of phenomena. For what reason does the Tathagata designate a Bodhisattva as being wise with respect to the character of phenomena? So, same question as the previous chapter. The previous one said, when you say Bodhisattvas are wise with respect to the characteristics of mind, thought, and consciousness, just how are they so? So it's the same style of question and answer. Now it's going to be about the character of phenomena. Character or characteristics or marks is the word in Sanskrit, lakshana. Lakshana, the marks of phenomena, the character or characteristics, qualities, maybe we could even say. In this case, it's a very general word at this point. The Bhagavan replied to Bodhisattva Gunakara, Gunakara, you're involved in asking this in order to benefit many beings, to bring happiness to many beings, out of sympathy for the world, and for the sake of the welfare, benefit, and happiness of many beings, including gods and humans. Your intention in questioning the Tathagata about this subject is good, it is so good. Therefore, Gunakara, listen well, and I will describe for you how Bodhisattvas are wise with respect to the character of phenomena. So, just like the last chapter, this is a good question. Gunakara, there are three characteristics of phenomena. So, So I'll just read this paragraph and then we'll go back and go through them more slowly, and in fact probably take a few weeks, because this is the definition of them here. So these characters are called the imputational character, the other dependent character, and the thoroughly established character. Gunakara, what is the imputational character phenomena? So I think this is the hardest one. So if this sentence sounds hard, it is, but we'll pull apart the sentence word by word afterwards. So the imputational character is that which is imputed as a name or symbol in terms of the own being or attributes of phenomena in order to subsequently designate any convention whatsoever. That's the hard one. Gunakara, what is the other dependent character of phenomena? It is simply the dependent origination of phenomena. It's like this. Because this exists, that arises. Because this is produced, that's produced. It ranges from due to the condition of ignorance, compositional factors arise, up to, in this way, the whole great assemblage of suffering arises. So that might sound familiar to many of you. That's an abbreviation of the 12-fold chain of dependent co-arising, which is this early version of dependent co-arising. Dependent on ignorance, compositional factors is karmic formations arise. You know, dependent on that, consciousness. How does it go? Name and form. The six senses and the six sense objects, the contact between them, the feeling that arises from that, the craving for a good feeling, the grasping at that, the becoming that results from that, birth, and then old age, sickness and death, and the whole mass of suffering. So they didn't list all those in-between links because it's such a standard Buddhist teaching. And it's not, we can go back to talking about this when we get into this character, but it's not so essential to understanding this part of the sutra here. It's basically the thing is, because this exists, that arises. Basic interdependence, dependent co-arising. What is the thoroughly established character of phenomena? It is the suchness of phenomena. Through diligence and through proper mental application, bodhisattvas establish realization and cultivate realization of the thoroughly established character. Thus, it is what establishes all the stages up to unsurpassed, complete, perfect enlightenment. So there's the definitions. Now the chapter will go into different metaphors and analogies to look at how these three work together, and then the meditation on how to know each of the three. Wait, it's time to start looking at this chart. Let's start with the other dependent, since that's the easiest, and it's kind of like the basis for the other two, in a way. So I don't know if you can see, this writing's kind of small, if you can see from here. I'll try to read it out too. So the center column is the other dependent character. In Sanskrit, it's called Paratantra. Three characteristics of all phenomena are the lakshanas, so Paratantra, lakshana. They're also, in other texts, other than the sutra, they're called the three natures, svabhava. So sometimes it's called the Paratantra Svabhava. So it literally means, Paratantra literally means other dependent. It means like dependent on others. So, but as it's defined in the sutra, as we just read, it's defined as dependent co-arising. But here they're calling it, for various reasons, there's the renaming it the other dependent. So other translations could be other powered, means that things are not power, don't derive their power from themselves. Their power to function comes from others. Dependent arising, the base of imputation will become more clear later. It's basically the base for this imputation. Imputational character imputes onto the other dependent. It can also, later in the sutra, it talks about this other dependent as being the signs of phenomena. So signs are like the way that we know phenomena, but let's not get into this at this point. Now this column I just put in, I wrote created by, I was trying to relate it to the previous chapter. Now this is not like a definitive thing from the sutras, but it does seem like, remember we have from the previous chart, right, we had the eighth consciousness, the storehouse, is the sum total of everything for a person, you know, in terms of an individual person, it's like all the conditions karmically planted and that give rise to each moment. So we could say that the storehouse consciousness is created by dependent co-arising. We could also maybe say dependent co-arising is created by the storehouse consciousness. We could also say they're the same thing, actually. And we talked about that a little, I don't recall, when we were talking about alaya. Like, they're kind of indistinguishable. And this sutra doesn't make that case so strongly, but Asanga seems to strongly imply that the storehouse consciousness is this inconceivable sum total of everything that's ever happened to us, in this moment. And it's inconceivable, ungraspable, and it gives rise to all our other experiences. Now that sounds also a lot like the interdependent arising of all phenomena in the universe. It's just that this is a kind of psychological model, psychological version to call it storehouse, and other dependent is more just like dependent co-arising of all phenomena. It doesn't have such as quite a psychological slant, although it is. So I think these are highly related, if not identical, the other dependent and alaya. These other two we'll get into when we talk about them. Another way to talk about the other dependent, also up here it says conventional truth. The dependent co-arising is like what's called the relative truth or conventional truth, as opposed to the thoroughly established suchness or emptiness is the ultimate truth. And imputational, as we'll see, is not even no truth at all. It's not even conventional truth. So dependent co-arising is also called the mere appearance of the world. Now, that might seem like strange. We might say, well, isn't it the actual dependent arising of everything? But actually, dependent co-arising is ungraspable. It's not actually that there are dependently co-arisen things. Often this is, for years, thinking about dependent co-arising, that's how I thought of it, is like, well, there are things, it's just that they're dependent on other things. But more accurately, it's more like that there's appearance of things. Like there aren't, because so-called things, so-called phenomena, depend on other things, and particularly they depend on our mind, they just appear to arise for one moment. They're not actually things, you know. I mean, conventionally we could call them phenomena, dependently co-arisen phenomena or things, but actually things seems to be made by this imputational character. It seems like that the other dependent co-arising is actually just the mere appearances. But it's the world that we live in. It's the world, all this appearing world. We take it as more than just mere appearance, and that's what this is going to get into. But if we took away our projection of essence onto things, then there would just be the mere appearance, dependently arisen appearance of phenomena. Does that make some sense? We could say the dependent arising is the world, but to make it a little more accurate, let's say it's the mere appearance of the world. Yes?
I often wondered if the dependent arising is the best term for our vernacular. Dependent connotes to me a real linear thing, you know, this, then, that.
Uh-huh, yeah.
But I'm also aware...
It's not like that.
No. I'm also aware, just in, you know, simple causality, that a given cause can produce multiple effects that aren't necessarily related to each other, you know.
Well, but in a way we could say they are related to each other, not directly.
Not in a dependent way.
Well, not in a linear dependent way.
Well, that's what I'm saying.
That's what you're saying.
Linear. So are there other terms you can use?
Well, one that I like is interdependent.
Interdependent.
That puts a little different twist on linearity, right? Because, and I think that's what the co-arising is intending to do too. Dependent co-arising means that actually everything in a whole situation is interdependently co-arising, as opposed to like this arises and then that causes this over here. The co-arising means simultaneous. Just like when we're talking about the eye and the color, dependently co-arise, interdependently co-arise. One doesn't cause or the other. One doesn't condition the other.
So that's the first time I've heard interdependent co-arise.
Yeah, I think we can say that.
Yep. That seems right.
Yeah.
What's the
Sanskrit word? Pratitya samudpada. So, Pratitya is dependent or conditioned.
Yes.
Dependent or conditioned. It's related to pratyaya, means condition. So pratitya, we could also say conditioned arising, or dependent or interdependent. And sam is like together. And pada means arising. So dependent co-arising is a very literal translation of pratitya samudpada. Sometimes it's a dependent origination. I think that works too. Utpada, arising or origination. We can mix these. Interdependent co-origination. All of that works. Sometimes people reverse the terms and say codependent arising. I mean, that's not so literal, but...
What did you say that...
It maybe means the same thing.
Pratitya
samudpada.
What did you say that pratitya meant?
Like either dependent or conditioned.
Conditioned.
Okay. Mm-hmm. It's like an adjective in this case. So conditioned, co-origination, interdependent, arising... So I think it's a wonderful term that has these two sides. One is about things are arising in the moment, that they're not there inherently, but they're arising, and that they're interdependent. So it encompasses both those sides. And because they arise, they cease. There's also interdependent co-ceasing every moment, as well as arising. Arising short for arising and ceasing. Good. And the mere appearance part is not in the term itself, but I think that's when we look at what it actually is, we could call it mere appearances.
Mm-hmm. I wonder if you can, for phenomena, if you can, when you're talking about these, maybe is there an example you can use? I don't know, maybe you can use a cow or you can, and kind of, for me, if I could think of something.
We're definitely going to do that when we put the three together, use examples, and the sutras examples too. But just as we're talking about this one now, It's pretty easy because we could... Well, I think it's a good question because we should say that other dependent phenomena and the characteristics of all phenomena, we're talking about mental phenomena. So in a way, loosely speaking, we could say cows are phenomena, but really a cow is like a, in terms of our experience, a cow is like a mental image. So, for example, Abhidharma, like Buddhist psychology, says there's like 75 dharmas that make up all of our experience. And there were another school that said there's 100 dharmas that make up all our experience. And it does that list of 100 does not include like cows and horses and stuff. It's just like mental factors, but it would account for, we have to account for our experience of cows and horses. So we'd say like, we'd say a cow, our experience of a cow is includes maybe like 15 out of the 70 dharmas. This would be what the Abhidharma people would do. They would say like, well, it's a visual object, it's maybe a tactile object, and it's a mental object, and it's a smell object. And it's like, yeah, so we have an, but then the experience of the cow might also include like pleasure or not pleasure, all our responses to it. So in our experience of a cow is a highly complex thing that's not just one phenomena. But often it helps to, like, when we're getting into these examples, to like you talk about the three natures of a cow, for example, just because it's easier to like pick a physical thing like that. But in that case, I think it's nice to say technically what we're doing, I think, is we're using a mental image of a cow when we're talking about analyzing it in terms of these three. So basically every, it's phenomena that we experience is what a dharma is. Dharma means phenomena in this case, or thing, but things are things that we experience. And I think this is nice because it's not just the mind-only school that's saying this, but even right from the start, Buddha was defining phenomena as things we experience. Because that's all we have to go on.
Is it important for us to start relaxing our notion of linear time and space as we deliberate this?
That would be good. I mean, relax all notions. And we can get into talking about how time and space actually have three, they're phenomena that have three characteristics.
Because we're still talking about precedence and subsequence, you know, consequences and all these kinds of things. We kind of lock ourselves into a very linear way of looking at causality and codependence.
I think that a nice thing about that earlier chapter and all our discussion about how these consciousnesses work and how the mind is creating the whole world and we can't ever experience anything outside of mind, which I, by the way, a little footnote on this is I was just reading this this piece about idealism, and so sometimes Yogacara mind only gets criticized for being idealism, and it's saying if we're talking about ontological idealism, which means that that there really is just the mind and there's nothing other than that, like in terms of an ontological status of like what actually exists, that's not what mind only is. But at least one person said like epistemological idealism, which means like in terms of our experience, all we can ever know is what is through our mind. That is what Yogacara is saying. It's like and the difference between those is a big difference, but people can slip back and forth between them without noticing it. Could you follow that? That's a little bit hard, these terms. It's more like...
What was the term called?
Ontological means like, or metaphysical idealism would be another one, or we're setting up something, like there really is a creator mind It's when Buddha says, I don't teach this storehouse to children because they'll take it as a substantial self. Mm. They'll make it into a metaphysical entity. Mm. So it's very dangerous. Mm. So that's not what mind only is saying. But if we say it's epistemological, which is this word that means how we know things, epistemological idealism, mm. to use these fancy Western philosophical words. It does. And I, you know, after I made this chart, some of this stuff was not in the sutra. It's later teachers do this stuff, and I almost came back and crossed it out because it gets tricky, but it also is fun, so we'll leave it on for now.
Just give us a nice disclaimer.
Yeah, I'll definitely give a disclaimer.
Yeah,
the sutra is pretty straightforward on not getting metaphysical or ontological, it seems to me, except, well, we haven't gotten, when we get to the thoroughly established, I recently heard that this is the Tibetan translation for this word, and actually, people make a case that it's not an accurate translation, that it's more like the perfect is a better translation, which has a parinishpana. Oh, I mean the Sanskrit. I don't know in Tibetan, actually, yeah. But yeah, I'm not sure. Anyway, so continuing with the other dependent, the sutra, as you heard, that was the whole definition that it's going to give. It's dependent co-arising. When this arises, that arises. Later, what Asanga does, and I think this is helpful to tie this all together, I think, is he defines it as this, you know, this previous chart, right? These 18 elements. The senses, the consciousnesses, and the objects, those 18, that's called the other dependent character. I thought that's a really amazing thing that he does. So yeah, when he's defining what is this other dependent character,
yeah.
he says it's basically all our experiences.
All that other chart,
yeah,
is this middle one.
Is the middle one, yeah. Because it's basically everything. It's everything. And in this chart, this is everything. Well, these 18 encompass all our experience. They're everything. When we could, and so here's Alaya. Remember, here's the storehouse, is number 8, which actually all 17 others arise and lay back into 8. So in a way, you could say 8 includes all of them. So we could just say the other dependent is the storehouse, which I was saying earlier. But we could expand it in terms of thinking about it, saying, well, it's all our conscious constructions of the world, and the way that we do that is these 18 things make up our world. Remember, this is like a model of map of the mind of the person and of the world. Because this right-hand column of objects, this is kind of like what we think of as the external world that we relate to as color, sound, smells, taste, touch, mental objects like cows and horses. And so all of that, but including the sense organs and all, because as we know, as we reviewed from this, how those work, they're completely interdependent. These 18 are like inconceivably working together, particularly the, you know, like the eyes and the colors. We talked about how they dependently co-arise. So that's our apparent world, is consciousness. So the sutra doesn't say that, but I think it really opens up this whole, and the meditations on this is going to really open it up too. Makes it very dynamic, and it ties it into the previous chapter. So let's not go into these columns yet. Let's first just define them. So now we have the imputational. Parikalpita. So pari means like completely, like, so parinirvana, right? It's like complete nirvana. Pari means complete. We have it in both sides. This is parinishvana, parikalpita. And kapita is like imagined. For yoga people, you might have heard of like nirvikalpa. Nirvikalpa samadhi means like beyond all imagination or unconstructed, non-conceptual. So if you, without the near, it's like completely conceptual, completely imagined, mere fantasy, conceptually grasped or projected. These are all loose translations. I think like completely imagined or completely imputed is a very literal one. Yeah.
So then this is, it doesn't arise with an object. Because if the middle one is the codependent, mm-hmm. like perception object arising mm-hmm. together, mm-hmm.
now
then
this is
just fantasy
based on this. This is its material to fantasize about. So this is these mere appearances, mm-hmm. and then it's going to like fantasize that those mere appearances are actually not just appearances, but they're actually things.
The imagination?
The imagination that it's really real. Mm. And it's going to, because it's a particular kind of imagination here, as the sutra defines, but an imputational is this word that's often used. So, which is a word we don't often use in English, right? So I wrote down the dictionary definition of impute. So impute is to lay responsibility or blame for something, often falsely or unjustly. Like you imputed that crime onto me. You know. Which it doesn't literally mean, but it's kind of nice because it kind of like is imputing a crime onto the other dependent. It's kind of saying that, it's kind of saying there's these beautiful, dependently arisen mere appearances, and it's like saying, no, you're real, I'm going to get you and grasp you. And it's kind of like, it's falsely charging, you know, in the way that you impute a criminal.
The attribution of otherness right there?
Yeah, that's one way to talk about it. Yeah, attribution of otherness. Mm-hmm. Attribution of duality, subject-object duality. Now the sutra, we're going to go into what it says. It says it in a very kind of difficult word. So imputation is like an attribution or ascribing something or charging something. I also looked up some of these other words because this imputational character is the key thing to this chapter. This is, it all revolves on what exactly is happening. How is this imputational is working? So imagine, I thought very nicely in the dictionary, says to form a mental image of something not present. Mm-hmm. Fits very nicely with this. That's what we do. We form a mental image of like a cow when there's actually not an actual cow there, even when we're seeing the cow. Because it's just a dependently arisen mere appearance of like tactile sensations and visual objects. Okay, so then here's the definition that the sutra gives. Now it's a little bit different in this case. What I wrote is that which is imputed or posited or imagined. These are all synonyms. That which is imputed in terms of names and symbols. So I think the sutra says as names and symbols. And then in terms of the own being, it reverses the as and the in terms. And I don't know if this is like in the original Tibetan, because later in chapter 7, it uses this order. And when I contemplate these are subtle distinctions of words, but I think this works better, I feel like, for understanding what it's saying. So excuse me for slightly shifting the wording from this translation. That which is imputed in terms of names or symbols, so basically that's what in terms of means. We use these terms, we use names. And symbols is, I think they're trying to be really accurate and really flesh out this whole picture and cover everything possible. So they could have just said in terms of names or terminology, I think one says. But symbols is nice because the way I take that is that we can do this even without names. And this is, I think, how babies can do this. Before they have language or names, they still have symbols to categorize things and make things using symbols. If we don't have a word, we're going to find some way to do this. We are like hardwired to do this. So in terms of names and symbols, now I put in parentheses because chapter 7, it says this actually, something like this. Imputed to the other dependent character. This one we just read doesn't say that, but it's that which is posited or imagined in terms of names and symbols, you know, imputed onto, imagined using these dependently arisen, ungraspable energy soup. That's another thing. I forgot to write an energy soup. We were talking about Alaya as the energy soup, right? But I think you probably, Nanette, would agree that we could, the way we're talking about the other dependent also, would you say dependent co-arising is like this energy soup where we can't get a hold of what kind of vegetables are in there. It's not even vegetables. It's just, even to say energy is a little bit off, but it's completely ungraspable. And we basically impute onto the energy soup. There's this energy soup that we say, like, potato. So, but we use a name, or if we don't have the name, we use a symbol of something that looks like a thing that you plant in the ground, like a potato.
But don't we get into areas of agreement and disagreement as to what this phenomena is?
Very much, yeah.
And, you know, you could have actual disease of the mind where you could see, you can smell green. You know, it's sort of,
yeah,
I mean, we all agree that a cow is a cow because we all agree it.
We might not even all agree.
Well, we might not all agree,
mostly.
But generally speaking, a cow is a cow. But, you know, not, you know, I mean, when you think of scientific discovery, you know, where one scientist makes this discovery and says, this is what it is. And, you know, 20 years later, someone comes along and says, no, it's not.
Like, who was it who said the Earth is flat?
Well, the Earth is flat, or, you know, talking about Newton and then Einstein, where you live in a Newtonian universe and you can get along just fine. And then Einstein comes along and says, well, wait a minute.
Yeah. And this will probably keep happening in this world. And in fact, it may be happening in this very class, that we're redefining a world. I mean, it's been done before. But I think this is a very good point. Is, yeah, we this energy soup, we don't agree what it is. We can't agree what it is, actually, because it's undefinable. And yet we try, automatically, we try to define it as this or that. And in fact, so this would be, and we disagree on what it is, and then we often fight over that. So this is one of the liberative functions of this thing, when we start to see how we're basically continually non-stop imputing. And holding to that as real, that's the cause of so much problem. Whereas if we know that everything we're doing is imputation, literally everything, every experience we're having, then we can be more flexible, or what did Johnny say? Hold things lighter or something?
Loosely,
hold things loosely. Then already that's a huge practice. Relax around our
imputations. So in here we have
imputations.
The genesis of beliefs and conventions.
Yeah, yeah.
Which are taken as real.
Yeah, exactly. But it's getting, you know, gross conventions and beliefs, and subtle ones like that this is paper, or like, you know, that I see this as gray. Even that's imputation. That which is posited in terms of names and symbols to the other dependent as, so what's it, what is it imputed as? What is it posited as? The own being, or essence, or attributes of phenomena in order to designate any convention whatsoever. So this is a very dynamic definition. I highly suggest memorizing the version in the sutra. It's just like it's a one long sentence. If you memorize it, you'll see it has all these different parts. One is the linguistic dependence, names and symbols. One is the actual positing and imputing, and one is, what is it imputing as? This is the essential thing here, that it's imputing, it's imputing an own being or essence onto the other dependent. And so this is this technical term. Own being is svabhava. So the Madhyamaka people is a key term for them. That's basically what Nagarjuna system is all about, refuting svabhava. Basically emptiness. Svabhava is called own being. In the Heart Sutra that we chant, we say all five skandhas are empty in their own being. So that's svabhava. So that sentence is very similar to this. when we say empty, empty of what? Empty of own being. Literally, sva means like own or self. And bhava, it means being. Like, remember the, we're talking about this third type of wisdom is the wisdom from becoming. It's called bhavana maya prajna. And bhavana means, I think I mentioned before, like cultivation, meditative cultivation, but literally means being. And it's one of the 12 links in the 12-fold chain of causation is bhava. And in this case, an own being, or another translation would be self-nature, or essence, I think is a very nice Western philosophical term. The essence in things. Or attributes of phenomena, in order to designate anything, the sutra says, I think, in order to designate any conventions whatsoever. And the thing about attributes is, again, just, it's a little bit like saying names and symbols. It's just like making it a little, it's like covering all the bases again. It's not so essential, but I take it to mean. So we have a brown cow that we impute, we take the name cow, and we first there's this other dependent experience of a cow through our senses and our mental apprehension. We have, there's something there, and then we take this name cow and we impute it to this inconceivable soup as an essence of a, like an essential cow. Or the attributes would mean like, it's a brown cow. The way I understand this would be like the brownness of the cow. So it's like it's essentially brown. I think it's really saying the same thing, but it's just getting into subtleties about adjectives as well as nouns, that we can essentialize qualities like brownness as well as objects like cows.
Just like a flesh-colored crayon?
Yes. Yeah, like that. So maybe it's good to look into this word more, this svabhava, this essence. Another common translation I think is very good, literal, inherent existence. So sva means inherent, and bhava, being or existence. Inherent existence means like things exist inherently in and of themselves. That's another way to talk about it. Things exist in and of themselves. In other words, independently. Now that's not a literal translation, but it is the meaning of self-nature or own being. It means independent existence. And so we impute independent existence, self-nature, own being, onto this soup through names and symbols. So you're starting to get these, this is what it's saying. It's using a lot of big words to say this thing, which I think the main thing is it has these two aspects. One is that it's imputing essence or inherent existence onto ungraspable, arising and ceasing, flux of experience. It's solidifying it into things, and it's doing it with names and words. those are the two sides. And I think it's a very accurate way of talking, is why they use some of these, this kind of hard, difficult language.
I've been struck by it in the Diamond Sutra. It focuses so much on no, that doesn't exist. It's just called that. It's just a name for that. But in the Hawaiian Cloister, he talks a lot about just concepts. You can let go of, of the conceptual mind, developing concepts of reasoning. And so those two. Just what you just said, they kind of go together.
Yeah, they're very similar. I mean, this kind of thing is definitely highly influenced by like the Diamond Sutra and the Prajnaparamita and the Heart Sutra. And then I think Huangbo is highly influenced by this, mind only, particularly.
For a long time I was thinking it was just names that caused the problem. It was just a name.
Yeah.
Naming imputes a lot more than just a word.
Yeah,
so
yeah. And this, and also, it's very interesting. Yeah. And my current understanding is that we can't do one or the other. After a while, I used to think like, well, couldn't we just name it without without imputing essence onto it? Just loosely name it. And maybe as bodhisattvas, once we learn how we're doing this, maybe we can do that kind of playfully. But I think in general, even if we're doing it playfully, I think as soon as there's a name, this is how I currently understand it, we can't, because the name singles it out of the soup. In order to name it, yeah. So when we're talking about, we might think, well, okay, what if I say that this pile of papers is not inherently existent? I know it's just dependently co-arisen, but I can still call them dependently arisen papers. It's like, we can't. I mean, that sounds like we could do it, but I think the very thing is, even to call it dependently co-arisen, we're still attributing it a very subtle essence, or maybe not so subtle essence, onto it. That's why I think this mere appearance thing. There aren't dependently co-arisen things. Is key. Yeah.
One way that I'm kind of thinking about this, which I want to check with you, is this left column, this imputational characteristic of phenomena, is completely delusional. So this is like, this is completely delusional. Yeah,
that's
completely
true.
Wrong.
Yeah.
The middle one is, it's relatively true.
Mm-hmm.
It's sort of how we all kind of experience things. It has more awareness of the reality of the situation. Like, to think that's paper with words on, it's completely false.
Mm-hmm.
But to see that that's actually an appearance of paper and call it paper, there's something relatively true about
it. Yeah, that's the world we function in.
There's still delusion there in a way.
Yeah,
and
there is.
This column, which we haven't gotten to yet, is actually how things actually are in the ultimate sense.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So it's sort of like from completely delusional to
completely undelusional.
With a little more insight or vipassana into the nature of things.
Mm-hmm.
Is that kind of make sense to think of it?
Which is kind of like up at the red here on top.
Yeah.
You know, this is conventional or relative truth. It's relatively true. And in fact, it's the truth of relativity and conventionality. And this is the ultimate truth that's ultimately true. And it's not a thing, actually. It's and this is not, I said, no truth at all. When we're talking about there's the two truths in Buddhism, so you're classifying, this is called the conventional truth and the ultimate truth, but this one doesn't fit into either.
In a way, it seems almost like a layout of the path. Like, you start here, completely delusional, and it's incredibly radical. I mean, I don't know if I'm thinking about this right. I don't know if it's ever described this path, but you start out thinking, that's really paper.
Mm-hmm.
You'll go to war because that's really paper.
Yeah.
And then, as you practice, you start to realize, well, maybe that's not as real as I think it is, and you start to sort of see some aspects of that its appearance and that there's all kinds of sense consciousnesses and awaya and karmic tendencies going into perceiving that thing.
Mm-hmm.
So you're a little less attached, and that's a huge radical leap in awareness.
Yeah.
I don't know if I'm thinking of this right, but it seems like there's qualities of path there.
Now, sometimes it's talked about as a progression, 1, 2, 3, like that path, but often not so much. Like sometimes, like it's more commonly, I think, talked about is first you start meditating on how things are dependently co-arising, and then you start meditating on the subtler point of how we're projecting onto that, and then you realize this. But the point that you made, a progression like this, we have these analogies that we'll get into more later, but just because you brought it up, the one about the snake and the rope, do you remember this one? It's a great metaphor, analogy in general. So, you know, in the dark, you see a snake, and then you look closer, and you see it's actually just a rope. So you projected snake, an essence of a snake, onto something that wasn't really there. So these are just analogies, but in this analogy, this is a Sangha, I think, too, who does this. So this is a very classical way of looking at this. First you see the snake, and then you, once you see that it's not really the snake, it's not your imputation, then you see it as a rope, which is like the other dependent. But then when you look even closer, you see it's not even a rope, but it's just the fibers that make up the rope. Or that, yeah. So that's, of these metaphors, that one in particular has this path progression of 1, 2, 3, it looks like to me.
But it does make sense.
The other ones don't so much.
That you start here with a contemplation, and then you realize how much you've been doing all along.
Yeah.
Only through that practice.
Yeah.
That makes sense to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in chapter 7, with part that we won't get to probably in this class, because it's a long chapter, the Buddha gets it. Chapter 7 is basically all kinds of elaborations on these three characteristics and the three non-natures, like the three emptinesses associated with these three, which I hope we will get to that. But at some point in the chapter he says, first I teach bodhisattvas to meditate on the other dependent character, and then that helps them like calm down, actually. It's like, and it helps them see how, and it creates like kind of like ethical conduct. It's related to that. He says, when you see, because it's related to impermanence, everything's other dependent, and therefore it's all impermanent and not as graspable as we thought, and therefore we kind of like, I think he says, then you realize that nothing's reliable or dependable, including other beings, and nothing in samsara is trustworthy or reliable, and he's saying that's a good thing. We had loud conversations like, that didn't sound so good. But actually you have a realistic attitude, you know, you can't really trust dependent co-arising things, they're just like out of control, actually. And then you can like settle down more, and then you can start meditating on this very subtle thing that the mind is continuously doing of projecting essences onto things.
So as I heard Janet speaking and you just now, three words come to mind that may or may not be applicable, but arbitrary, useful, and reliable. First column is arbitrary.
Mm.
But it can take on some usefulness and then when it gets into that second column.
Hmm.
But even that's not totally reliable. Reliable would be what's in this third column, which is basically inexpressible.
That's very nice. But arbitrary, useful, and reliable. I think that's great to actually try to put these things in your own words like this. I think that sounds accurate to me. Another, when studying this before, somebody came up with calling it, they called this one the mystery, this is the dream, and I forget what they call it, this, like the reality or something. So when there's no dream in the mystery, there's reality, something like that. When there's, so if we talk with that kind of sentence, maybe it doesn't work to say, well, maybe it does to say, when there's no arbitrariness in the usefulness, then there's the reliable.
The indestructible.
Indestructible.
What about compassion?
Compassion is a...
Doesn't
phenomena.
Quite reliable for me.
Well, what do you mean? What about compassion?
It just seems like it's in that other dependent
arena, yeah,
that there would be a use for compassion.
Mm-hmm. Compassion, we would say. Well, in a way, I think this is really good to remember this part too, because anything we talk about now, this is one of the greatest parts here. These are three characteristics of all phenomena. So in order to have any experience and phenomena are almost the same. So anything we can experience or any phenomena always has all three. It's not like some phenomena have just some, which is, I think, a really cool thing to contemplate this. So you say, so I started to go there when you say, what about compassion? Well, compassion has three characteristics, actually. Like everything, compassion has this other dependent, inconceivably wondrous way that it's like coming to us all the time and we can't quite see it. And then it has, then we call it compassion. Oh yeah, that's like when you're like, try to be with people's stuff. We like make it into something which isn't really it. And then it has a thoroughly established, now we haven't talked about this yet, exactly. So this is parinibbana. Again, it's completely, thoroughly, you could say this is thoroughly imagined. This is thoroughly established. So again, this nibbana as established, I think that's what one of these Tibetans was arguing, that when they translated it to Tibetan, it's a little bit off. It's more like, I think nibbana means more like complete or perfect, which is a little less reifying, still might sound a little reifying, than established sounds a little bit like inherently existent, right? So completely perfect, perfectly real, consummate, the consummate character. And the definition we just read in the sutra, interestingly, when they defined them there, they just said, what is the thoroughly established? Well, it's suchness. And through diligence, bodhisattvas can realize it. But they didn't relate it to the other two. It will later in the sutra, but suchness or thusness, ta-ta-ta, is if they're synonyms. So actually, and as it becomes clear later too, suchness is a synonym for emptiness. Or an emptiness is a lack or an absence or a voidness, shunyata. Those are how it's usually interpreted. So I think this is a nice point too, because suchness is such a wonderful word, isn't it? Like we maybe even like Suzuki Roshi's things as it is. I don't know if he meant this kind of suchness there, but in English I think it works very well. Thusness or suchness, and we often think, well, it's things as they actually are, but I think that doesn't quite work here to say things as they actually are, because it's more like things as they aren't. You know, it's really more, if suchness is an emptiness, it's that actually things aren't things. And the fact that things are not things is their suchness. Mm. At least according to this sutra. And I think that's true in Prajnaparamita also. But it has this, this sutra is doing this funny thing here. Because this is partly in response to Prajnaparamita, which is all about emptiness, lack, absence, voidness. It's trying to make this point. This is plays with this a little bit by calling it suchness and by calling emptiness and suchness especially if we say the thoroughly established. Whoa.
A characteristic, too.
Yeah. And it's a characteristic, yeah, of all phenomena have emptiness, we could even say, as one of their characteristics, one of their qualities. Yeah. Yeah, so that's like, this is like the kind of the good news column.
Okay. Empty. Would it be examples of other qualities? Would it be the other two columns?
Yeah, and I mean, we're talking about, do they have any other characteristics, yeah, besides these three?
Yeah, you have emptiness. I want to be sure of what the qualities, things related to this, qualities can be used.
Well, maybe we should say characteristics rather than qualities.
Okay, so is it just these other Would you say one of the qualities or one of the characteristics?
According to this system, there's three.
Okay.
I think within the system, we probably say there aren't more than... Everything fits into one of the three when you make up a system like this. All, you know... It's also an interesting play on... the Buddha's apparently the second sutra the Buddha ever taught after setting in motion the Wheel of Dharma was called the Anatta Lakshana or Anatman Lakshana Sutra. So it's the characteristics of no self sutra, and he said that's why he said there's three characteristics of all compounded phenomena. I can't remember exactly how the sutra goes, but I think it's kind of like with kind of compounded phenomena have these marks or characteristics of, you probably heard this, suffering, impermanence, and no self. So early Buddhism has three characteristics, and they probably are playing with that idea to call it like all, there's like, here's a new Mahayana version of three characteristics, completely different, but they're using the same word.
Suffering,
impermanence, and no self.
So can we relate those to that? The suffering and imputation?
Interesting. Maybe so. Yeah, this is kind of like no self. This is kind of like suffering. And this is kind of like impermanence. There's somewhat... Yeah, maybe it is a play on that.
Look at the fixation. Fixation is the cause of suffering. Then that first one is...
Yeah.
They're
not exactly aligned, but they're related, yeah.
But as his thinking matured, then he might have settled on these things.
Yeah, and this is a much subtler presentation of the mind's working than those first three, which were the Buddha's second teaching, right? So it's just like, let me try to make this really, like, basic. Okay, everything is suffering, right? So this is saying, well, let's, like, look, is it really suffering, or is it just suffering when we do this? This very subtle thing continuously of imputing essence. Maybe. And also this column, I kind of made this up, but I wrote created, the other dependents kind of created by Alaya, and then we have the seventh one, remember the seventh afflicted mind organ that imputes self onto things. It's afflicted with a view of a self. So I kind of thought that, well, maybe this imputational character that imputes essences onto things is what's created by Manas, the seventh consciousness, if you remember that story. And then if we're trying to relate 6, 7, and 8, you know, these three columns, 6, 7, and 8 to these three, you could loosely do this, but I don't think you can say the thoroughly established is created by the six. But I wrote known indirectly. I just tried to make a link there. But then after I wrote this, I came across another teaching that said actually that the imputational character is kind of created by or functions under the auspices of the six consciousness. So I was like, oh. Which to me made it seem more subtle. So this is a little side footnote. If this seems too confusing, you can ignore this, but since I probably will forget to ever mention it again, I think it's kind of interesting that Manas, in that version that I just read, is only makes the view of the self of the person. So, as you remember, maybe we talked about Manas thinks that the Alaya is me. Like this is a particular thing of the self of the person. In Mahayana Buddhism, these two kinds of no self. Actually, early Buddhism, they're only talking about people, yourself. In Mahayana, it's like people don't have self, but also dharmas, phenomena don't have a self. It's, in other words, empty.
This third column, I wonder if I can relate to the first four chapters of the sutra, which is the ultimacy.
Yeah.
When you talk about dharma gates,
mm-hmm.
boundless, or about it. What we're saying here is that every phenomenon is a gate to ultimacy.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, and that's a great connection to that third Bodhisattva vow.
Yeah.
Yeah, we can maybe think of it in these terms. Dharma gates are boundless. Means like every moment is a Dharma gate to the ultimacy.
So
every experience.
The gate to ultimacy.
To ultimacy, yeah. 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 I think that's what the more we start to see this, the more it seems that this is, yeah, it's like, it's like every moment is an opportunity to just like realize this thing, which looks really complicated when you put all the words on paper, but the more we understand what the words are pointing to, with the second kind of wisdom of reflecting, what does this actually mean? Then it's like, it's something very simple that's happening all the time, and the, like the freedom and the bondage are possible at any moment. But it's a very subtle thing. It's continued. This is not just like sometimes. The way I understand imputational is it 24 hours? I mean, at least if we're dreaming, I think it's happening. I don't think it has to be like we have to be naming. And so what about, you know, deep zazen, when we're like really letting go of conceptuality? That's a question. Depends how deep, I think. You know, if there's a slight, I think the way this is usually talked about is just very, very subtle and slight forms of just like a sense that like I'm here and the Krishna's down here, or whatever. Even if without gross names and labels. And then it can get very gross, like when we're yelling at somebody, like, you idiot! It's like a really strong imputation, but it can go very strong to very weak, but the same function. It's like to realize this.
Not necessarily always in balance. Although it's one could be more predominant than the other.
One of these three, you mean?
Or, yeah, some combination of those, depending on the moment.
You're talking about
these? The three characters.
Depends on your mind.
Where your awareness is of what's happening. How you are related to.
Yeah, depending on their awareness. I mean, I think we could say, because all phenomena have all three, always. So I think, so in terms of our experience, one thing that came up was like, if we really realize this completely, it's kind of like there's no phenomena. You know, if you realize this in a completely non-dual, non-conceptual way, at that time, these two aren't operating, but that's because there's no phenomena. So you can have just this one, like Buddha. But for Buddha, there's no phenomena. Now, Buddha still can live in the world, but I've been coming across a lot of things recently that they say, when they get into like, well, how does a Buddha like get through the day, you know, and manage this kind of world, like, appearing world. The system usually doesn't go, they don't get into that because, and intentionally they don't. Maybe partly because it's inconceivable, and also because if they made some theory, like this is how a Buddha does it. And there are some theories, I think, but that we would just grasp onto it. We just impute onto it. So they're like, let's, as it gets to a certain point, if we get further and further over here, we're not going to say how it's going to work. So we kind of have to leap at some point.
It doesn't say the Buddha is more operating in the world. It just says they won't suffer while they're operating.
But it's not exactly a world for them either.
No.
You know, it's like there's some, you know, can they construct some appearances in order to like help people in the appearing world, which in this chapter later is going to have this thing about strongly adhering and not strongly adhering. So one theory is that, like, they could maybe loosely adhere just enough to like see a world of sentient beings to save. compassion. I think compassion, we maybe need to be in the world of phenomena, actually. That's maybe another point about it, is that we're all three are operating, but if we leave the world of phenomena, I don't know if there's compassion. Now, there is the Buddha's ultimate compassion, but it manifests in the world of phenomena, it seems. So how that works, how a non-world relates to a world. We're not going to get into it. No.
The known indirectly, I think, on the third column, pretty much. Known indirectly.
Yeah.
There's something happening here that indirectly knows, and that's why we work.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I don't, you know, it's like mind is just a mind is doing. But we don't know it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, indirectly. Or also, I wrote that because it's like, again, these three kinds of wisdom. So when we can come to know this as in a conceptual way, and then often when they talk about these, Tibetans that get into all these, like, well, how does this transition from conceptual to non-conceptual? They get into this, all these like little stages along the way, and maybe they're just talking about something that's
more concepts.
It's, they get more and more subtle, and you can have a, and this goes back to this discussion around Jean's question about non-conceptual versus non-dual and the distinctions between these. But usually it looks like they're saying that you can even have a non-conceptual realization of suchness, which means like, you're seeing how, and we can do some guided meditations in these things. I think soon will be really fun and great, and I try to do these things myself sometimes to put it into practice. But I think it's good that first let's really get more familiar with it, this whole system. But it's more like when you see how you're imputing, and then like you might be able to actually let go of that, for a moment. And you could have like a non-conceptual, like maybe there's actually not phenomena, but then I've been trying to propose that it's still maybe subtly dualistic, because it's a conscious, if it's going to be the sixth consciousness, it's not yet, it's still divided, it's still discernment, discrimination is what consciousness means. So So also in this column, so it's the emptiness, but it's particularly, the sutra doesn't say it at this point, but later, does say, it's the emptiness of the imputational in the other dependent. So it's relating these two. Isn't that cool? It's the emptiness of this imagination in this inconceivable soup. So, which is a kind of dynamic thing too, because it's not just emptying out the other dependent at this point. If you use that definition, it's saying that like it's giving some credit to this working, mm-hmm. What did Johnny call it? Working.
It's really there. It's something you can impute something to.
It's not exactly that it's really there, but but it's that the emptiness is saying, it's really saying this is not in this. And it's not saying whether there is or isn't this, but it kind of leaves that possibility.
Yeah.
It doesn't say it's getting rid of both of these.
Yeah.
That's why I think it's a nice relationship of these two.
Conventional world.
So these three completely work together. This is also why this kind of step-by-step thing, in talking about it that way, is not quite like that. It's that this is the absence of this in this. And this sutra doesn't say it, but later Asanga says it and so on. It's the emptiness of subject-object duality. And so this is the connection between these two kinds of emptinesses. The emptiness of the imputational in the other dependent, and the emptiness of the non-duality between mind and phenomena, subject and object. There's some... heavy-duty debate about, like, are these the same thing or not? Are those two emptinesses the same? And I think it's a great reflection, once you get understand what they're saying, to reflect on whether they seem like they are, to me, they actually seem like they're saying the same thing. But they're just, it's like looking at this whole picture from two slightly different angles. And sometimes it's said that they are the same thing, they're the same emptiness that's realized in the end, but that this one is easier to realize than this one. This one is a good stepping stone, sort of, for this one. This may be too much for today, the difference, but if you wrote it down, you could contemplate. And then this part to say that it's that the thoroughly established is non-dual wisdom, or Buddha nature. That's not in the sutra, and, you know...
Where's that from?
Later tradition, no, it's not me. I wouldn't have never done such a thing.
You would never just sneak something on there for us?
No, that's too much. But I like the traditions that do this are the in the Tibetan schools, are the meditation schools most similar to Zen, like Dzogchen, Mahamudra traditions. They're the ones who like to say, and I think they're saying, and you can find like Keizan Zenji saying things that sound very much like this, that I think they're saying it's not just absence. I think that's why they're saying it, that there's this, there's Buddha nature, or there's awareness. It's completely non-dual, you know, ineffable, non-conceptual, inconceivable wisdom, but it's like we're alive. It's like it's like light. It's not nothing. Yeah. Yeah. So you find particularly Keizan likes that side.
When I'm in deep samadhi, yeah, and everything is just humming, and somebody in the vendor sneezes, I have a non-conceptual awareness of touching, and I'm flying off. It just is right there. Boom! Like that.
Yeah, probably like a second after. Yeah. But there could be things like, or I think of, yeah, and you know, and they use the kyosaku, the stick. It's this very loud, sharp sound, and I think that's partly like it's just, you can have, you know, it snaps you out of what your conceptuality, you hear somebody else getting hit, or yourself. It's like, for 1 second that you have, in Dzogchen tradition, they say, like, when you're really at that place, you or somebody else goes, and you—that's same idea. It's just like, and they said there for that one moment, you have fresh, complete, non-dual.
And that's the pebble dropping in on the bamboo.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
And then I was.
Yeah,
awakened,
yeah.
You know,
and it's not something happening, just, right? Yeah.
So there we go.
So we got a little bit into that, and you can read ahead in the chapter about how. I think this the paragraph on page 2 about how each of the three are known is, if you want to read ahead, and actually that's a great paragraph to memorize. I have to say, I think, you know, memorizing things gives a whole, you really get familiar with the words. It's this first kind of wisdom. And then you they open up in a new way from when you just hear it once, or at least read it over and over until it's like, and I think this is a good translation. Like, they really... There's no kind of extra words. And maybe there's a few. May our intention equally extend to every being and place with the true merit of Buddha's way. Beings are numberless. Illusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to render them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable.